by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering Baltic bakery bread, caviar, and baklava. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
You're listening to WILL Urbana and a performance of music by Johann Sebastian Bach, the aria from the Goldberg Variations, admittedly not something that you generally hear on this station. This is the second hour of Focus 580. My name's Kevin Kelly. I'm sitting in for David Inge this morning. And Glenn Gould was the performer in that. Glenn Gould is the subject of our conversation this hour, certainly one of the most fascinating musicians to exist, I think it's probably fair to say. And there are many things one can say and have, and people have said positively and negatively against or for the man and his performances. And here with us this hour is the author of a brand new biography of Glenn Gould. It's called Wondrous Strange, The Life and Art of Glenn Gould. His name, Kevin Bazzana. He is with us online. He is a musicologist from PhD from the University of California, Berkeley, a freelance writer. He edits the Glenn Gould Journal on behalf of the Glenn Gould Foundation. He's program annotator for the Toronto Symphony Orchestra and has a previous, more academic work, I think, Glenn Gould, the Performer and the Work. Kevin, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Glad to hear that you're actually there online.
Yes.
I guess the first thing I'd like you to say to our listeners, assuming that a great many of our listeners have probably not even heard the name Glenn Gould or may have heard the name and know nothing more about it, how would you introduce this man to those listeners?
Well, I would say that among classical performers, he would certainly have to be one of the most individualistic that you'll ever come across. And I guess for someone who I guess would like to know, you know, why should I listen to Glenn Gould? The answer would be that regardless of how much you know about classical music or how many performances you've heard of a particular piece in question, when you hear Glenn Gould play it, you will hear something you've never heard before. Something unusual, something compelling, something provocative, something to make you think. And, you know, I have a feeling that even years from now, his performances will still sound fresh and provocative because they're just so unusual. And, I mean, I guess that will always be the main reason. Also because, you know, Gould's story is a wonderful story as well, you know, in terms of life stories and personalities. This is really one of the real queer ducks of classical music history, and it's fun and intriguing to read about him.
I almost started by asking you, is this guy a nut or what? Because
well,
people have asked that.
Yes and no.
Tell us, I mean, we might as well get this out of the way. Glenn Gould is perhaps known at least as well for the ways in which he was a nut, or eccentric is the nicer way to put it, as for his music making. So give us a thumbnail sketch of what are the things that Glenn Gould did non-musically, and then we'll have a couple of examples of some of the eccentricities musically.
Yeah, well, he was for one thing, he was a real loner. He wasn't quite the hermit that a lot of people thought he was, but he did not like public life. And, you know, in terms of his career, the most radical thing he ever did was give up concert life. So, you know, he was 31 years old when he gave his last concert, and though no one quite believed it, he never did give a concert again. He just did not like crowds. He did not like public situations. He did not like unfamiliar circumstances. And, you know, he was a real homebody, you know, lived in his apartment with the, not only the shades drawn, but basically sort of permanently, you know, protecting himself from the sun. He lived a backwards life. He stayed up all night and slept during the day. You know, he had strange dietary habits. He was a terrible hypochondriac who fussed and fretted over his body and worried about every little cough and twinge. He rationed his human contact fairly significantly. He preferred to be in touch with people over the phone, so he was kind of a virtuoso telephone user. So, you know, you get this odd image of Gould as this guy who's, you know, living alone, something of a mystery, a bit of a hermit, in the middle of the night, sitting on the phone, talking away to somebody in some far distant place. He was a very interesting, odd fellow. He had no real use for the normal trappings of fame either. I mean, he wasn't really interested in money, except in terms of what it could do for him in the sense of realizing his artistic ambitions. He didn't care about his material surroundings, you know, if the temperature of the room was right and, you know, the light was right and so forth. It was quiet. That was fine. He had no sort of celebrity preoccupations, didn't have an entourage, lived alone, did most of his own sort of day-to-day tasks, you know, handling his mail and paying his bills and that sort of thing. Just a very unusual non-celebrity celebrity in a lot of ways, with this strange, somewhat reclusive lifestyle, and a rather, well, in terms of what was known to the public, a completely unknown sort of private and sexual life, too. So, I mean, really just an unusual case, shall we say, in almost all respects.
And musically, how was he unusual, if you can say that in any brief way?
Well, first of all, you know, he was a recording artist, which, in his view, I mean, was not the same thing as just, you know, someone who goes into a recording studio and makes a record. I mean, all musicians have to do that. But he was a true recording artist in the sense that he thought of that as a completely different art form from giving concerts, and it had its own standards and its own possibilities and its own ethics and so forth. And one thing he believed is that the fact of recording had changed the ground rules, really, for classical performers, in the sense that there are so many surviving recordings of particular pieces of music, the most popular ones, of course, especially, that there was no need to record these pieces again unless you had something different to say about them. And so there was a sort of self-conscious desire to make his mark as an individual in his interpretations. And so, as a result, almost everything he played, particularly the works that are the best known, actually, has a really individual stamp to it. It'll be faster or slower. It'll be smoother or more clipped it'll be louder or softer or something than what you expect. So, you know, if he's playing something like, you know, a greatest hit like the Moonlight Sonata, for instance, or one of the famous, you know, Bach preludes or something, you could absolutely predict that he will find some unusual path through that piece that no one has ever thought of before.
Well, since you mentioned those pieces, in particular the Bach, we have queued up here two different performances of a piece that probably many, many people who have played piano at all have played themselves. I can fairly say that I can actually play this myself. It's one of the few things I can. And it's the first of the preludes from Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier. And I've picked two recordings, both of them. The other recording happens also to be by a Canadian, and I don't think we've even mentioned so far that Glenn Gould was a Canadian, so we'll certainly come back to that. So what we're going to hear first is a performance, and then we'll fade it, of by Angela Hewitt, who was a contemporary Bach specialist, who did many other things as well. And then we will hear, right after, Glenn Gould playing the same thing. So there we had two performances of the first of the preludes of Johann Sebastian Bach from his Well-Tempered Clavier, Angela Hewitt performing first in what was really a pretty normal way, I think,
yeah.
And then Glenn Gould in which was Glenn Gould's way.
Well, you know, this is one of these pieces that, you know, everyone knows, and it has a long sort of performing tradition, and everyone sort of knows how it's supposed to go. You know, it's just a series of chords going up and down the keyboard, and you know, on the piano, particularly with the sustaining pedal, it's usually played in a very you know, poetic sort of way. Well, there's a real self-consciousness and even a tongue-in-cheek quality to Gould's performance, because you know what he's telling you in that performance is, you know, I am not playing this the way it's supposed to be played. I mean, you know, Gould knew how things were supposed to be played. You know, it's not that this was done out of ignorance. He just was determined to offer something different, and he seemed most determined to do that in the pieces that are most familiar, because that is precisely where the greatest number of expectations are built up. So if he was playing a Mozart sonata or Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata or the Appassionata Sonata or whatever, these were the pieces where he really looked for something distinctive to say. And again, this self-consciousness has a lot to do with his view of himself as a true recording artist. He didn't think of recordings as, you know, an adjunct to a concert career or as a way of making money or as a way of publicizing his own career. He really thought of them the way a composer thinks of compositions, as permanent works that will survive and become part of a permanent body of work. So, you know, just as Beethoven, when writing a sonata, knew that he was adding another sonata to an enormous pile of existing sonatas and wanted to add something new and distinctive, Gould felt that way about his recordings. Because, you know, Schnabel's Beethoven exists, Gieseking's Beethoven exists, Zirkin's Beethoven exists. You know, his idea was, why should I record a Beethoven sonata again if I have nothing different to say about it than these previous artists have?
The piece we just heard also had some other highlights of his style. Let me reintroduce our guest and our topic here to our listeners. My name is Kevin Kelly. I'm sitting in for David Inge on Focus 580 here on WYML Urbana. And we're talking with Kevin Bazana, who is the author of a new biography on Canadian pianist Glenn Gould. It's called Glenn Gould, The Art and what is it?
Wondrous Strange, The Life and Art of Glenn Gould.
There you go. I've got two different books open here and all kinds of papers in front of me. And this is out from Oxford University Press. We are very happy to take phone calls. Our phone number here is 217-333-9455 if you're in our immediate area. And if you are not, you're welcome to call us on a toll-free line. It's 800-222-9455. And we do have a call on line one. Go ahead. You are on with us right now.
Hello?
Yes, you're on.
Hi.
I just listened to the piece from the Paul Tumpert Klavier, and I kind of have an idea of what Gould may have been trying to accomplish in his interpretation. Am I right in that?
We are having some trouble with our phone lines,
I wanted to know what he was trying.
Yeah, well, we've lost him. So he was on a cell phone. Caller, if you're able to call back on a different kind of phone, that might work better. But again, we can take calls 217-333-9455. And apologies for that. We have been having trouble with the phones all morning. But I said that the well-tempered clavier performance did represent a number of hallmarks of Gould's performance. One is that he sort of plays with this very often. He plays with this very clipped sort of sound.
Yes.
Very short and pecky,
yeah.
Very often.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if our listeners could hear it all that well, but what may well have come across in the radio is it might have sounded like somebody had a radio on behind the recording and was sort of talking away, and in fact that was Gould himself.
Oh, yes. The notorious singing, yes.
Which is fascinating to watch also. I've seen some videos of him and some of the photos as well where he, I think, even though some people were annoyed by this singing business that shows up in all of his recordings, it seems to me that expresses this enormous amount of joy that he felt in playing.
Actually, that's a very good word. That really comes across in his videos. And, you know, it's something you don't see all that often in classical performers, which seems a little surprising. You watch someone like the conductor Herbert von Karajan, you know, and you see this sort of aristocratic figure for whom music is this deadly serious business, and yet some of the really great and interesting musicians, like Gould, like Leonard Bernstein, like Carlos Kleiber, you know, you really do see a kind of joy on their faces, which I think is very meaningful and very, very, very moving sometimes. The clipped playing that you were talking about, you know, Gould's I think highest value as a performer was clarity and transparency. You know, the thing that he was probably most renowned for was his playing of counterpoint, you know. So whenever music was, a piece he was playing was very dense and had, you know, two or three or four or even five or six lines of independent music going on at the same time, he had an uncanny ability to render that clearly. for the listener, which I guess made him, you know, the perfect performer for music like Bach's, of course. But, you know, that clarity was always something he aimed at. And even when he was playing, romantic music with a very singing kind of style, a more lush style than Bach, you know, Brahms or Mendelssohn or some of the romantic music he played, there was still this remarkable clarity. You know, things didn't blur together in his performances quite the way they often do in other people's performances.
We do have, he's gone now. I thought we had a caller back on line one, and he's disappeared. So, again, our apologies for trouble with the phone lines. A lot of the performances, it seems to me, and to many other people, of, as you said, famous pieces and sometimes not so famous pieces, seemed to be Glenn Gould thumbing his nose at either the establishment or that particular composer.
Right.
He had some very famous dislikes. He quite often enjoyed saying how little he thought of Mozart as a composer.
Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned earlier the Beethoven Moonlight Sonata, which is actually one that he liked. But he would record some of these pieces that he supposedly didn't like. And then you hear these performances and you think, well, that's pretty obvious. Why did you bother? I mean, what was his point in doing that, do you think?
Well, this goes back to something I said before about his insistence on making an individual contribution to the catalog of recordings. It's interesting that he spent, 10 years off and on recording all of the sonatas and fantasias of Mozart, some of which he didn't like, some of which he really didn't like. and yet he devoted very, very little time, comparatively speaking, to recording the sonatas of Haydn, which he much preferred to those of Mozart. And I think the reason might have been was that, his goal was not necessarily just to play things for the sake of playing them, but to play things about which he had something individual to say. And it could be that in the case of Haydn, though he loved the music, he didn't have a particular point to make that justified recording them all. Whereas with Mozart, he really had a point to make. Not just, he wasn't actually recording them to say, I don't like these pieces. That's really not the case. But what he did think was that the way people had thought about Mozart's sonatas in the past and the way people had played them on the piano was, in his view, misguided. And he wanted to offer an alternative that he thought, in many cases, was more suitable to the what he saw as the actual nature of these pieces. He thought of them as highly entertaining pieces of light music. And what he objected to was this sort of heavy, sentimental, Victorian style of performance that he thought had accrued to Mozart's piano pieces over the years. So I think with his recordings, it's not just a matter of playing things for the sake of the repertoire or even just playing things that he admired, but playing things that he had something to say about.
He also talked about, and this, you're sort of leading to a topic, perhaps, that maybe gets to the heart of Glenn Gould, and that is that he felt there was a certain morality of music. And I want to hold that just for a minute and let our listeners hear another example of this individuality of Gould's, this making his own statement, clearly doing something different with a rather familiar piece that we've mentioned a few times, which is the opening movement from the Sonata of Beethoven that has come to be known as the Moonlight Sonata, which was not his title, by the way. Somebody else gave it to him later, but somehow it always seems appropriate. So what we're going to do again is hear two different performances back-to-back of a portion of this opening movement. The first one is a little fuzzy sounding. It's from 1956, another very famous performer who Gould actually didn't like very much. I'll have a quote if I remember to bring it up here in a minute. Vladimir Horowitz will play, and then we will hear Glenn Gould. Thank you. Two different performances of the opening of the Moonlight Sonata of Beethoven. First, Vladimir Horowitz in a fairly conventional, slow, really lovely way. And then Glenn Gould, much faster, obviously. But personally, I found as it went along, you kind of get convinced rather quickly and you forget about the about how other people play it.
Well, yeah, I mean, Gould really was a compelling performer. And even in some of his strangest performances, they're convincing in the end because he was convinced by them. And, you know, this idea of doing something new and individual, it wasn't really, you know, as superficial as that can sound. It really was a matter of him wanting to do something that was not only individual, but also legitimate and provocative. So, I mean, he wasn't really just trying to thumb his nose at convention, even though a lot of people accused him of doing that. There really was, in most of his strange performances, a real inner conviction that actually comes through.
We are talking with Kevin Bazana, who's author of a new biography of pianist Glenn Gould. And we do have a caller. I want to throw out something else provocative first, since I mentioned that Gould was not a great fan of Horowitz. Nonetheless, was frequently compared to him. And Gould was occasionally asked, directly actually, whether or not he was gay. And I'm quoting here from your book, where you're quoting Gould, and he says, "I always quote Horowitz that there are three kinds of pianists, homosexual pianists, Jewish pianists, and bad pianists. And I add, pianists who play better than Horowitz," which I think is a marvelous example of his humor and way of dodging that question. But let's go to line four, where we do have a caller into the program this morning. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. It took me back to the 60s when I first started collecting Gould. And unfortunately, I'm not in any sense a trained musician, so I didn't really know what I was getting into until I had some friends over who were music majors. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, vaguely sour faces at times. And since I really didn't know, whether you should be doing this or doing that, or, you know, what you keep talking about legitimacy, and I don't really know what that means in terms of what things you can do with, thing that's on the page, so to speak. I'm sure it's not jazz. And speaking of jazz, another person who used to do that singing and humming was Earl Garner.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually,
trouble with him at times. I have an oldie. I think it was Concert by the Sea, where in some cases he's louder than his piano playing.
Yeah.
But it never bothered me because I guess it just seemed sort of normal. If someone had pointed it out to me, I would have thought perhaps something about it, but. Usually, you know, people with their horns are blowing the horns or whatever and stuff like that, but somebody that's free to use his, you know, other parts of his body for expression, I would normally expect that from a musician.
Well, other classical artists have done it too, and you can hear it on their records. I mean, Toscanini was a bit of a grunter at times, and so was Pablo Casals, the cellist.
I think you brought back a memory on that too.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot. I just wanted to call in and say that there are those of us out there that. One thing about Gould, wasn't he quite tall? And if so, and also, what kind of span did he have on his hand? How many keys?
Well, he was fairly tall. He was very frail, sort of physically, and a bit of a hypochondriac. And so a lot of people have this idea that he was a small person, but actually.
Yeah.
He was fairly tall. He was just shy of 6 feet, actually. Fairly thin, though.
Yeah.
I actually don't know what his precise span is. He did have large hands. I don't think he could take in a 12th, like the really huge-handed people like Rachmaninoff. But I think easily a 10th.
Yeah.
There's actually been a few years ago a doctor who specializes in the medical and psychological issues of performing artists developed a theory that Gould might have had a physical predisposition to the kinds of physical problems that have actually laid up certain pianists over the years, like Leon Fleischer
mm-hmm.
and Gary Graffman.
Mm-hmm.
suggesting that had Gould played a different kind of repertoire that really punished the hands on a regular basis, he might have ended up, you know, crippled by it the same way, which was an interesting theory.
Yeah, it's remarkable. They didn't know anything about that at all. Yeah. Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work, both of you.
Thanks for calling.
He said something interesting about the reactions of the professional musicians among his friends, and that's, you know, there are pianists who revere Gould and always have, but you'll never find, more vociferous grumbling about Gould from anyone more than from certain professional pianists. I mean, you know, in a lot of ways, Gould is a real provocation to them, and so you'll also find some of his loudest critics among pianists, like Alfred Brendel, for instance.
What sorts of things would he say about Gould, or has he said?
Well, you know, Brendel has talked about Gould in many interviews, and it just seems as though he just cannot understand why you would do this, why you would play softly when Beethoven tells you to play loudly. You know, why you would ignore this marking, why you would play fast in a piece that's supposed to be slow. I mean, you know, for a performer like Brendel, it's all about respect for the composer, respect for the score, trying to get into the mind of the composer and see what his intentions might be. For Gould, it's a much more personal and creative business. You know, what can I add to the history of this piece? That seems to have been his goal.
There's an article that Gould wrote, and we haven't talked yet about Gould as the non-pianist.
Indeed.
Which was an enormous. Enormously prolific non-pianist.
Indeed.
But there's this marvelous article that he wrote about the conductor Leopold Stokowski, who. It was not terribly fashionable for other musicians to admire Stokowski, apparently.
Right.
But Gould did, which is really interesting because Stokowski was another musician who made a lot of recordings in the studio. And here's something that Stokowski said in the course of an interview that Gould did with Stokowski. And I'm quoting Leopold Stokowski now. He says, "Black marks on paper. We write black marks on white paper, the mere facts of frequency, but music is a communication much more subtle than mere facts. The best a composer can do when within him he hears a great melody is to put it on paper. We call it music, but that is not music. That's only paper. Some people believe that one should merely mechanically reproduce the marks in the paper, but I don't believe that. One must go much further than that. We must defend the composer against the mechanical conception of life, which is becoming more and more strong today, etc." But the idea that, you know, the performer himself, Gould in particular, Stokowski also, were in a way recomposing pieces that had already been written.
Yeah. Well, you know, Gould always wanted to be thought of as a creative musician. He wanted desperately to be a composer when he was a young man, and he did write some pieces, including a major string quartet in the mid-50s, and he really thought that when he gave up concert life, he would be devoting himself mostly to composition. It didn't turn out that way because I think when faced finally with that prospect, he had to admit to himself that he didn't quite have the gift or the voice to be a composer. But what he did end up doing is channeling all this creative energy he had into other kinds of work, and one of those was reinterpreting the pieces of other composers. So, I mean, there was a fascinating article written about 15 years ago by a Canadian composer from Quebec named Jacques Etu, and Gould performed a wonderful set of variations that Etu wrote, and Etu was thrilled that a performer of Gould's stature was recording his piece. He was a little bit mystified, though, why, you know, Gould never contacted him. You know, performers tend to contact living composers and ask them for their thoughts on their pieces, but Gould didn't want the composer's thoughts on the piece. He didn't care. And Etu said that when the recording first came out in the mid-60s, he was mortified by what Gould had done with his piece. And, you know, basically, you know, wouldn't get out of bed for 3 days because he was so shocked. But then he, all he examined the recording more closely, and he realized that, you know, Gould's performance had a real logic to it, a real legitimacy to it. It contravened what the composer wanted, and yet it had its own compelling logic. And A2 eventually came to accept Gould as a kind of colleague. You know, he said, here is a performer who thinks of himself as a composer and thinks that it's his right and even responsibility to provide his own creative take on what's been written. And he, in the end, accepted Gould's recording as a legitimate option. That's a very liberal attitude for a composer to take. But, I mean, if you think of Gould that way, you know, there are many, many riches and rewards in his discography for you to find. The Brendels and such like, unfortunately, get very little out of listening to Gould except ulcers.
Well, it's funny that Alfred Brendel was one who didn't think much of Gould, and both of those pianists are known for having terrific senses of humor, showing it in their playing as well.
Well, yes, Brendel has very little sense of humor when it comes to things like the institutions of classical music life. I mean, Brendel is very serious about his task as a performer, and he's very serious about the concert hall, and he's very, you know, that sort of thing. Gould did have a wonderful childlike sense of humor. He also had a more provocative sense of irony and subterfuge at times. I mean, there really is a real sense of irony running through a lot of his performances too. You hear that in his Mozart sonatas, for instance. I mean, he's not only offering an alternative to conventional performance of Mozart, but he seems to actually be sort of poking fun at it, or even indulging in a bit of parody. And that's unusual in classical music, to find that sort of that streak of irony.
We do have a caller here. You're listening to a conversation on Focus 580 with Kevin Bazana, the author of a new biography on the pianist Glenn Gould. And let's go to line one. You are on Focus 580.
Thanks. One of the most remarkable recordings I have is a CD of Gould playing Handel and Bach on the harpsichord.
Mm.
Very strange and interesting things, and for people who like the harpsichord, it's maybe even more of a departure than his piano interpretations. Want to say a word about what he did with the harpsichord?
Yeah, he made one harpsichord recording and also one organ recording. I'll let you in on a little secret. Gould recorded the Handel suites on the harpsichord because shortly before that recording was scheduled, someone dropped his piano.
I heard that story. I heard that it was exactly an accident like
and
that.
The piano was in the shop. Now, of course, he could have just canceled the recording. He wasn't forced to do this. But he decided to do it on the harpsichord because he thought it would be fun.
Well, it certainly is.
It's a very rich, colorful, dynamic recording, that's for sure. It's not, shall we say, idiomatic to the harpsichord in a lot of ways. I mean, I studied the harpsichord. That was my instrument, particularly at university. Uh-huh. And, you know, one thing you generally try to avoid doing on a harpsichord is bashing the keys so hard that you hear a little thump of wood every time you make a note. Well, that's precisely what Gould did because, you know, as he admitted, he did all of his practicing for that recording on the piano.
Uh-huh.
But you know, it's a very dashing recording. There's a great sense of fun and high spirits in that recording. He loved to play with the different registers of the harpsichord, so it's a very colorful recording, and it drives professional harpsichord players crazy to listen to that recording. And the same with his organ recording. He recorded. The first part of Bach's Art of Fugue in the early 60s on an organ, and that was also considered both refreshing and, sacrilegious by organists. You know, he wanted to get away from the sort of romantic standard of big, lush, colorful organ sound, and the organ sound that he preferred was very tight and very clipped and heavily well articulated. So they were both rather outrageous interpretations.
Sort of the other direction from what he does with the harpsichord. Huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks very much. I look forward to the
book. Thanks for that.
Thanks for calling. And didn't he also play on this an instrument he kind of had made for himself called the harpsipiano or something?
Oh, that's right. That's right. Now, this is actually not a Gould invention. This sort of instrument had been used, like Mahler used one, for instance, in some performances of early music, and I think Ravel did as well. It's a small, in Gould's case, it was a small piano, like a baby grand, with little metal pins stuck into the hammers. So a piano hammer is this wooden thing covered in felt that hits the string. And so depending on how plush the felt is, it makes a, you know, percussive but somewhat muted sound. Well, when you stick a pin in it, of course, it makes a twang. And the intent of this thing was to be able to play a piano and do all the things that a piano can do, get loud and soft and have the sustaining pedal and so on, but sound like a harpsichord, because a harpsichord has a kind of metallic, twangy sound. And so there were a number of concert performances in the and TV broadcasts in the early 60s where Gould used this, he called it a neurotic piano that thinks it's a harpsichord. And at one point, he threatened to record the entire Well-Tempered Clavier of Bach on this harpsy piano, but he was dissuaded. It's a strange piano that sometimes it sounds like a banjo.
Well, I'm sure that Bach has been played in the banjo.
Well, Bach actually can be played on a banjo, which is interesting. But you know, this was a typical sort of thing that Gould liked to do, is sort of push the limits, particularly when it came to the instrument. You know, one of his although he was one of the great natural pianists of all time. I mean, his natural gifts as a pianist were just, and as a musician, were just awesome. And yet, it's almost as though he didn't like the piano. It's as though he wanted the piano to be anything but a piano. And he always said, you know, when he played the piano, he was always trying to make it sound like other things, you know, oboes and bassoons and string quartets and organs and human voices and synthesizers and so forth. You know, that was always his goal as a pianist, was to try and sound like he was doing anything other than playing the piano.
Well, since you mentioned that, we are, I'm sorry to say, coming already near the end of the hour, and we've only got about 5 minutes left to talk about the rest of Gould's life, which was the great revelation to me as I read your the book, is that he spent an enormous amount of time in radio, mm-hmm. and some in television, and doing some things that were innovative there as well that people still look to as pioneering techniques.
Yeah, it was already obvious when he was a teenager that he was not going to be content just to play the piano. And so he wanted to be a composer. He wanted to be a writer. He wrote an enormous amount. I mean, there's a 500-page Glenn Gould reader. There's another book called The Art of Glenn Gould, which is another 500 pages or so of writings, and there's still tons of unpublished material. You know, he gave lectures. He wrote, he composed. He did radio, not just in a casual way to disseminate performances, but as a real radio artist. In addition to performing conventional recitals on the radio, he invented a whole highly idiosyncratic style of radio documentary. He made these fascinating programs. One was about the Canadian North, one was about Newfoundland, one was about Stokowski, one was about Pablo Casals, one was about Strauss, Schoenberg. You know, he made all these fascinating documentaries that he called contrapuntal radio. And it was this strange mishmash of principles of documentary and drama and music and film. And they are documentaries on particular subjects, but they also are sort of musical compositions in a strange way. They're these strange tapestries of spoken word and music and sound effects and so on. Pretty avant-garde stuff, really. So he was constantly searching for new ways to communicate with the public. At the time he died, he had embarked on a whole new career as a conductor. He was just 50 years old, but he was already thinking that his days as a pianist were pretty much over. And he was very seriously embarked on this new conducting career. And had he lived, I think, for the next, at least 3 or 4 or 5 years, he probably would have made all sorts of recordings as a conductor.
And I would imagine that had he done so, those recordings would be at least as controversial as his piano recordings.
Well, we have the one piece that he was able to record as a conductor, plus another piece that he rehearsed with an orchestra. Those are on tape, and believe me, they are as strange as anything he ever did at the keyboard. So there's no question that had he lived, we'd have a whole another whole discography of unusual Gould performances.
Well, I thought before we get before we have to end things here, we might hear a performance of by Gould that is not particularly unusual. It's of a favorite piece of mine, and I gather it's by Mendelssohn, and he said that he liked a great deal of Mendelssohn's music, in spite of the fact that Mendelssohn sort of falls in the period of time where he claimed to think not very much of people's music then.
Yeah, well, you know, here was a pianist who did not play the core of the piano repertoire. He didn't like Chopin, didn't like Schumann, Schubert, Liszt, Rachmaninoff, you know. And yet, as his Mendelssohn performances show, he really mastered that style. And, I mean, he could have made wonderful recordings of Schubert and Schumann and so forth had he wanted to.
And this performance... I just think this performance is beautiful. Let's just listen to it. This is one of the Songs Without Words by Felix Mendelssohn, played by Glenn Gould. I wish we had time to hear the rest of that. It's so short, but we have just about run out. That was pianist Glenn Gould playing A Song Without Words by Felix Mendelssohn, just as lushly as anybody else might, except he always has this marvelous musical line running through everything. He finds a line always and brings it out.
Yeah, wonderful clarity. And that's another reason why it's a shame he didn't record more of the core piano repertoire, because he would have brought such wonderful new insights to it.
You know, as we close here, we've been talking with Kevin Bazana, author of a new book about Glenn Gould. I'm curious about something. Who's your favorite pianist, if you have one?
Oh, my goodness. I'm totally on the spot here. You know, I really can't say. It depends on the repertoire, I guess. You know, I love Gould, obviously, but... you know, I adore Michelangeli, and I love listening to old Vladimir de Pachman and Chopin, and I love listening to Rosalind Turek as well in Bach. I just can't choose Rachmaninoff playing Chopin. I mean, really, it.
Oh, I was just curious because you've steeped yourself so much in the music of performances of Glenn Gould,
yeah.
And
let's just say the ones I do like. Tend to be the mavericks. Those tend to be the pianists that I really go gaga over. You know, the strange, highly individualistic ones that play like no one else. You know, Michelangeli, Horowitz, well, Percy Grainger, even Turek, Anton Querty up in Toronto, Ervin Nirajazi, the Hungarian pianist who's the subject of my current biography. So,
well, we want to say thanks very much to Kevin Bazana, who's been our guest this morning on Focus 580. Author of a new book from Oxford University Press called Wondrous Strange, The Life and Art of Glenn Gould. There's so much more that could be said about this really fascinating guy. And as I read this book, I came away with a lot more admiration and also some annoyance as I listened to some of the recordings. But I think ultimately a fascinating and fabulous musician. And thanks very much for writing the book and bringing him to us. This is WYLL FM Urbana. I'm Kevin Kelly. I've been sitting in for David Inge this morning on Focus 580. I've enjoyed it very much. Hope you've enjoyed this Off the Beaten Path program for Focus 580. It's 11:58, and we're going to go to Tom Rogers and the Afternoon Magazine.
Good morning, good noontime on WILL AM. Okay, hi, Kevin. Thanks for filling in for David Inge today. I'll be filling in for Celeste Quinn on the Afternoon Magazine. Coming up in about an hour, we're going to be talking with Catherine Newman, a social scientist from Harvard University. Celeste Quinn will be conducting the archived interview. Catherine Newman authored a book called Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings. Her experience in the communities that had experienced school shooting incidents in Kentucky and Arkansas, as well as, of course, the Columbine incident in Colorado. She examines what is left in the wake of those tragedies. That comes your way in the 1 o'clock hour at 106 this afternoon. We'll have our usual mix of news and information in the noon hour coming up after NPR News. Right now, though, a look at our markets at the noon hour. Here's AM 580 Agriculture Director Dave Dickey.